I'm really grateful that you're here too. I'm just grateful that anybody came today, this busy time. If you were here last week, is Diane here? Okay. I don't know if you were here, but she stood up and said that she thought she was going to give Matthew's 7, and so I had prepared in it. I'm standing back there going, no! And you might remember that story that's going around the church, but I want you to know it actually happened to my father, that he was at a in a sacrament meeting at a primary program. And there were two siblings that were on the program. I think I told this a couple years ago, but and they had practiced so much that they both knew each other's part. So the little boy, and they were the children of the bishop, the little boy stands up and gives his sister's part. And so she's right after him, and I can't say her exact words, but you can imagine in your head that she stood up and said, that SOB just gave my talk. You can just imagine the actual words coming over with great strength. What a great story. So, that made me think of Diane. I'm just grateful that my daughters are here too. I've got Annie, you don't know them probably, but Annie, wave your hand, and my mom, and my other daughter forgot her diaper, so she'll be back soon for her baby. But I thought I'd just give you a little report on the twins before we start in Matthew 7. A lot of you know I was expecting 5 baby boys to come in 2 months, grandsons. And my son Johnny and his wife, Suzette, who often came, had their baby twins. They were in the NICU for a couple of days, but they're home now and they're doing great. They were each about 5 pounds. And then Alex's baby was born first. And Kara, I know a lot of you know Kara. She had her babies on Friday. And one of them was born okay, and the other had the cord wrapped around his neck twice tight. And he died a couple of days ago. So let's see, yeah, yesterday, yeah. So anyway, that's been a big thing in our lives this last few days. And I just wanted to come anyway. Where else would you be but talking about the words that that come from heaven? So his name was Isaac. He was a perfect, beautiful little baby, and he's gone back to Heavenly Father. And his brother, Caleb, is doing great, lusty and strong. So let's start with Matthew 7. You may have noticed that we have split up each chapter, and that was kind of my idea because I feel like these this sermon called The Great Doctrine by many people is so important. This was the new revelation, this was the New Testament that Jesus brought when he fulfilled the law. So I'm hoping that you are really reading it and taking it into your souls. He starts out talking about judging in this last part of his sermon, and he tells us we better be darn careful how we judge other people. Why? Because life will bring back to us what we give out. So let's just read it, at least a part of it. Judge not that ye be not judged, for with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. This, so hold your place and go with me to Alma 41. 41, verse 14, and actually, I think it's, let's see. Yeah. Well, I've got the wrong. This has been a rather rattling week. I usually go through and make sure I didn't write down the wrong chapter, but this is where he's talking about, I'll just read it to you. He's talking about the law of restoration, Alma is. And it's Corianton he's talking to. And Corianton asks his dad a question, and this is Alma responding to his question. And Alma says, "See that ye are merciful. Deal justly, deal righteously. Ye shall have mercy restored unto you again, justice restored unto you, righteous judgment." And then here's the part, "For that which ye do send out shall return unto you again and be restored. Therefore the word restoration more fully condemneth the sinner." So when you judge, what you do comes back to you. Joseph Smith, in his inspired translation of this chapter of Matthew, adds clarity. He says, "Judge not unrighteously, that ye be not judged, but judge righteous judgment." So it works both ways. If we censor other people, if we judge them unrighteously, we will be judged as we have judged. But if we are merciful, then we will have mercy come back to us. Let me read you these three little scriptures, because it's not just here. So this is Matthew 6. "Forgive men their trespasses, and your Father will forgive you." And John 3:17. "God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world." And Ecclesiastes 11:1, "Cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days." So let me ask you this. What is unrighteous judgment? What's happening when a person does an unrighteous judgment? What are we doing? We're condemning, usually too quickly. We are being self-superior, right? Because then you can look down on a person. Maybe anger, jealousy, retaliation, criticism, all of that could be unrighteous judgment. Let's look at the next part of this little section, verse 3 of Matthew 7. "And why beholdest thou the mote?" And I know you've heard these, but you should read them again. "Why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Or how wilt thou say to thy brother, let me just pull out the mote out of thy eye, and behold the beam's in your own eye?" And then Jesus says, "Thou hypocrite, you hypocrite." That's a strong word. So a mote would be a little like twig, right? Or splinter, I guess. And a beam, you know, the great beam of this ceiling of a house. So you can see how he's making a great a contrast. So he's saying the hypocrite hides his own fault by posing maybe as a friend, but then points out the faults of everybody else, right? The hypocrite has no eye to see anyone else's virtues and is blind to his own faults, which are greater. So here's another question. I have a bunch of them. do we see another's faults because we have those very faults ourselves. We do, don't we? Like a person that lies all the time is very conscious of looking for lies in other people. Maybe if we're always looking for vanity, dishonesty, and intrigue, don't we always look for intrigue? That interesting word. Looking for the worst parts of people, maybe because we recognize them in ourselves. These are hard things to look at, but he's just saying it plain and clear here, with strength. So here's a question. Is it worse to be a hypocrite who won't or cannot see her own fault than to be openly wicked? What do you think? What does Jesus think? I think he thinks it's worse to be a hypocrite. Now that is an amazing insight, isn't it? How he thinks, how God thinks. And why is that? Why would you say? Why is he saying it's worse to be a hypocrite, maybe, than to sin? Because, here's why. Because there's no love in you when you are a hypocrite. There is no love. And love, he says in chapter 6 of Matthew, is the final frontier when you can love your enemy. So that's how I look at it. I mean, how can we judge when we really don't know another's circumstances, really? When we cannot see into the heart, when we don't know their motives, I mean, we're really ready to impute motives, aren't we? In Samuel 16, 1 Samuel, this is when the Lord is talking to Samuel the prophet about the boy David. And he says, "For the Lord seeth not as a man seeth. For man looketh on the outward appearances, but the Lord looketh on the heart." So Christ is pleading for us to judge with mercy, for then mercy will fill the earth. That's a lot to hope for, isn't it, right now? But, you know, it can start with us. So here's another question. We have to keep going. Are we to judge at all? Yes, we are. And what, as Joseph said, what is righteous judgment then? You know, we talk about what unrighteous judgment is. What is righteous judgment? I mean, how can you feel like you're okay? I mean, for a period of time, I listened to Dr. Laura. When she, you know, and man, she wants you to judge, right? I know you did too, Steve, didn't it? Let me just say what righteous judgment is not. Righteous judgment is not being morally neutral. Would you agree with that? And safe. It's making a decision. That is hard sometimes. I read this article years ago, "All Things Are Not Relative" by Michael Novak. He said, many sophisticated people love to say that they are cynical, that ours is a cynical age. This was about 12 years ago. They flatter themselves. They do not believe nothing, they believe anything. Ours is not an age of unbelief. It is an age of arrogant gullibility. It's kind of what, if you read Johnston in the Deseret News, he kind of was writing, he wrote his little article this week about that it wasn't a problem anymore that Mitt Romney was a Mormon. And I'm not saying you have to be Republican or Democrat, I'm just bringing it up. The problem was that people didn't care anymore. Nobody cares. He could have been a whatever, you know. So being able to make righteous judgment goes back in a way to the sixth beatitude, which is, blessed are the pure in heart. Those who are not double-minded, we've talked about being double-minded, who are not moved one way today and another tomorrow, or who think one way and then speak another, or who have two reasons for what they do, a good reason which they announce and a real reason which they keep to themselves. So Kierkegaard was the Christian existentialist, said, will only one thing, using will as a verb, will only one thing, and that the good. In other words, just have one light in your eye, which is also from chapter 6. If your light be true, then you will only want the good. In other words, have courage to do the true thing. So how do we know how to judge righteously? Because isn't that the underlying thing? How do we know what to do? And Mormon tells us, so let's just look really quick in Moroni 7, verse 15. And I'm going to skip a little bit, but for behold, my brethren, it is given unto you to judge, that ye may know good from evil. He's telling us here exactly how to judge. Here it is. And then skip over to 18. Seeing that ye know the light by which ye may judge, which light is the light of Christ. Don't judge wrongly. And then 19. Ye should search diligently in the light of Christ, that ye may know good from evil. So there you have it. The way to judge is through the light of Christ. And it puts responsibility on us, doesn't it? Because you can't have the light of Christ unless your eye is single to God. Okay. Let's go back to Matthew 7 and verse 12. Do you know what this is called? Let's just read it. Of course you know. Therefore, all things whatsoever ye would that men should do unto you, do ye even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. So what is this? The golden rule, right? So these things are all connected. This brings it back again to the law of restoration. Diane just came in and she missed my thing about it at the beginning. I know. But I stood up and said, you SOB, you almost stole my heart. You'll have to ask what they meant. I meant that. Okay. Okay, sorry. Now we're serious. Okay, so verse 12, we're back again to the law of restoration. What we send out will come back to us. And what we do to others, we're really doing to ourselves. Do you believe this? That it's really a law of the universe out there? Because I do. It has happened to me over and over again. Maybe it won't come back right away. But it always, always comes back. Okay. The golden rule is not a new law that Jesus was giving. It was taught by Lao Tzu and Confucius and Plato, and it's all through the Old Testament in its positive and its negative forms. So like negatively, Hillel, the great Jewish rabbi that was maybe alive when Jesus was a boy, He taught it negatively. He said, what is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. Interesting that he switched it, that a lot of people switch it. So when Bob Bennett was our senator and lost in the convention a couple of years ago, and I don't really care if you voted for him or not, I'm just bringing this up as an example. He in that convention when he went up as to be the nominee again, the Republican nominee, people were absolutely brutal to him and vicious. I can remember hearing Elder Packer, who when watching it, this display of incivility and crassness and entitlement, said, these are our high priests. And so what are we, putting out there? Does anybody read this anymore? Does anybody care? Our own people? The Indian chief, I can't pronounce it, Tadushkin, who was chief of the Delaware Indians in North America in 1780, said of the Golden Rule, it is impossible. It cannot be done. If the Great Spirit that made man would give him a new heart, he could do as you say, but not else. Isn't that interesting? I thought that was quite lovely. So that's all the negative, part of it. Jesus teaches it on the positive side. He says, do not only avoid injuring your neighbor, but do him all the good you can. Active kindness, for this is the law and the prophets. This is the true meaning of the law and the prophets. He's telling us here how to live with our neighbors, how to treat them, how do we want to be treated, and then that's how we treat others. What do you think people want most of all as a neighbor? I think we want to be treated like we matter. What do you think? Like you matter, like you're walking on this earth as important as anybody else, even despite our brokenness. Leonard Cohen sings in his song, If It Be Thy Will, he says, even here in our rags of light. We're in our rags, but they're rags of light. A few years ago, Rabbi Harold Kushner, 1995, spoke at BYU, the devotional, and I have read this over and over again for years. He said, at some level, we want to know that what we do matters. We all want to be judged. We want to be taken seriously as moral creatures. This is still him. I am convinced that every human being has an existential need for significance. That's why it is such a thrill when we get our name in the paper. We do incredible things. We go into medical research, we write books to know we matter. We also do terrible things. Assassinate the president, commit heinous crimes. The Golden Rule is a law of how to treat people because they matter. It's a law, again, of ultimate love, heroic love, and it should be inscribed in our hearts. Okay, go back to verse 6 of chapter 7, verse, staying in Matthew this whole time. This is a really interesting little one verse that has intrigued me and maybe you. Give not that which is holy unto the dogs, neither cast ye your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under your feet and turn again and rend you. Let me read you the New English translation, which is a little clearer. Do not give dogs what is holy. Do not throw your pearls to the pigs. They'll only trample on them and turn and tear you to pieces. What is he talking about? Swine and pigs were, of course, unclean to the Jews. So he's being really strong, as he is through this whole thing. I don't know about you, but this is exactly my experience. Not everyone can be trusted with holy things. I think that's what I'm being blind because he's being blind. He said in John 2, he did not commit himself over to man because he knew what was in man. He didn't do it either. Do you remember Jesus' response to Herod? When Pilate sends Jesus to Herod, so they bring, when he is arrested, they send Jesus to Pilate, and Pilate says, he's from Galilee. Galilee is under Herod's jurisdiction. So they ship him over to Herod. And Herod is very interested. It says in Luke 23:8, Herod hoped to have seen some miracle by him. He just looks at him like, a magic person. Do some miracle, Jesus. And it says, Jesus answered him, nothing. What a strong person. And it's the same thing in Mosiah 14 when it talks about him. Yet he opened not his mouth. He knows exactly what's happening and he's not about to enter into and to step into it. So I personally think a child is a holy thing. And my daughter, Alex, lives in L.A., and she has 3 children under 3.5. And everywhere she goes, she is disdained for having 3 little children. How can our world have come this far? Is she being trampled on? Are her pearls being trampled on and cast before, I don't want to be rude, but swine. I mean, I could tell you horrible stories she has told me. It's terrible. So, just lastly, perhaps it comes down to our real intent when we send out what is holy. Mary G. Romney said, I have found that if I tell everything I know and explain every experience that I have had, the Lord will not trust me. I found that really interesting. I read that as saying that if we do give away our pearls, we better be careful, and that our motives had better be true. Okay, verse 7. This is repeated a few times in the scriptures. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened. Do you notice anything about the rhythm of this? About what is happening? Ask, seek, knock. It's increasing in intensity, isn't it? Like maybe asking is lower and knocking. You can just imagine. It's not a little. It's like knocking, So in the first part, he is commanding us to ask, to seek, and to knock. But then he says, for everyone that asketh receiveth, and he that seeketh findeth, and whoever knocketh it shall be opened. What is he saying? He's definitely telling us he's going to answer us. Isn't he? Do we believe that? So maybe weakly we ask, in helplessness, or maybe languidly. I love that word, languidly. Anemically. Have you ever been anemic? You know what that means. It's that's maybe how we ask. And when we seek, are we searching? Are we going down, you know? And when we knock, there's a closed door. So Luke, in his version of this sermon, he connects this to the Lord's Prayer and also to this little parable of the midnight visitor. This is in Luke 5, and you can look at it. He says, Luke has this little parable. Let's go there, Luke 11. Because it's interesting that in the other Gospels, it kind of jumps around these teachings, or as Matthew put them in the one sermon. So Luke 11, verse 5, you can look down at it, but what happens is a man comes to another man who is asleep, a visitor at midnight, and he says, I have a friend who needs some loaves. So he's needy. And the man in the bed answers, or the man answers and says, I'm in bed, go away. That's not quite what he says. But. And then Jesus comments. He says, though he will not rise and give him because he is his friend, yet because of his importunity, he will rise and give him as many as he needs. So what does importune mean? Does anybody know? I have to look it up for the exact definition. And it means to press or urge with troublesome persistence, to request or beg urgently. What is Jesus saying? He's saying you have got to put out some effort. But if you do, you will not be turned away. So he's saying, be persistent in prayer. But he's also saying, you've got to ask. You've got to start. So here's this question. Why does God require us to ask first? Have you had that experience? That, I mean, I have, I'll be going along and I'll be, you know, thinking, I have this need, and then I'm thinking, I never actually even asked. And then I ask, just in my head. And it's like, I feel an opening. So we really do have to, like, ask. And why is that? Susan?
Well, I think
that
it's part of a humbling process.
The what process?
It's kind of a humbling.
Humbling?
Yeah,
okay. Yeah.
It's an action. It's something you have to do.
It's an action that you have to do, right?
It's also our agency, it's exercising. Otherwise, we just get to what's
needed. It's our agency. And that is, I think, so insightful, that part, yeah.
I think it's
Paula. And that's, she said, we have to recognize that we need him. So it's like humbling, you know, you're opening yourself up as not being.
And also recognizing the answer when it comes.
And recognizing the answer. I think you're all absolutely right. We have to engage and declare our intent. And we have to wrestle with God. Do you remember in Genesis, this is Genesis 32 and 26, this ancient story of Jacob wrestling with the angel, who maybe is God, you know, it's kind of unclear. And then at the end of this little incident, when, you know, Jacob is traveling, he lays down and he has this occurrence where an angel comes in. It's so ancient, you can't really. It's just this old story that probably happened. But he says, I will not let thee go except thou bless me. And in Hosea 12, he says, Jacob, you know, he's talking about this incident. Jacob has power over the angel. So do we have power? Any power with God? Well, I think he's telling us here how to do it. You have got to put out some intent and effort. And like Ollie said, all the things. So let's go to the second part of that little part in Matthew 7. He says, so he said, seek not. And then he says, verse 9, for what man is there of you whom if his son asks bread, will he give him a stone? You know, the loaf of bread looks like a stone, kind of. Or if he asks a fish, will he give him a serpent? Some fish look like snakes, right? God is not going to mock you. If you're asking, if you have true intent, he's not going to mock you and give you a stone back. He loves you. So we may not receive what we always want, right? But we can discover what is behind that door. And believe me, sisters, I have learned there's always something behind the door. It just may not be what you want. And when one closes, another opens. And if I could tell my children anything this morning, it's that. When a door closes, don't lay down dead. Wait for what is behind that door. Okay, 7 and 13. This, you know, you think, oh, this is boring, this part. Enter ye in at the straight gate. There are two ways. This is the gospel of the two ways. There is life and there is death. Enter ye in at the straight gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And many there be which go in thereat. Because straight is the gate and narrow is the way that leads to life. And few there be that find it. You know what struck me most reading this again and studying it was? Few there be that find it. Most people would think this is talking about eternal life, and it probably is also, but I'm thinking he's talking about, as usual, this is how you live your life. And there are few that can make it in there. Jeremiah said, I set before you the way of life and the way of death. See, the two ways. The way of death is wide and broad and easy. Forget discipline and self-denial. It's all about indulgence and avarice and pride, right? And ambition. But it's also death. There's no life in those things. And the straight way is narrow. Everything worthy has a narrow entrance. Do you think that? It's kind of a hard doctrine to want to have to accept. Because then you have to give up a lot of stuff that you like, right? My daughter is a pediatric neurosurgeon. It took her 13 years after graduating from college. And now she's finally working. All the student loans that we signed up. 13 years, how many roads did she have to give up in order to do that? Where she works on little children's brains and saves their lives. Do you, when your child has a brain tumor, do you want a person who has given up a lot of roads? I mean, I know a lot of you have your own things you're proud of, some not. But I just am saying, this, you know, that it takes some things. Are we willing to do the same sacrifices that we would to become a disciple that we would to become an athlete, say? I have a niece who's going down a very wide road right now. I adore her. I adore her spirit. And when I see her, I look at the pain in her eyes. I search her eyes because this is why she thinks she's carrying this secret. And what she thinks is that the secret of being on this broad road is dangerous and really fun. But, you know, it's not a secret, is it? We all know. We could be there. And that secret leads to destruction and a life of death. Because any life without the light of Christ, without His life in us and His light, is death, and there are only two ways. So, anything we want, that is, if we want to be Christ-like, we have to give up anything that isn't Christ-like, as you know. So that's why there are only few. And I bet you're all going, so I'm not saying there's only few of you. But who are the few? Who are those few? Does it tell us? Skip over to 21, verse 21. This is where he really gets a little bit brutal, I think. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name? And in thy name cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works? And then will I say unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. It's interesting, he's quoting Psalms 6 and 8 here, which says, depart from me, all ye workers of iniquity. He had those words in his head so he could quote them in his conversation. Why did he never know them? Why is he so, I think this is, it's kind of a, not an angry, but intense way of saying, why did he never know them? These people were doing things in his name. They were prophesying, they were casting out devils. What are they doing wrong? Joseph Smith translated, I never knew you as ye never knew me, which is interesting, but it's basically the same thing. Because what is he focusing on here, Jesus? He's saying, you have got to have real intent. You have got to be a true person. In Luke it says it's a little clearer. And why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? So these people use his name, but inside they are someone else. And who are they? He tells you. Look over in verse 15 through 20. We skipped over this part, but this is this little part where he talks about beware of prophets, he says, but beware of people who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. Well, that's a very strong way to say. What would a ravening wolf do? They would tear you apart. So it's a very descriptive way of talking about danger and of evil. So he's saying these people who do things in my name, you know, they're using my name, but well, who are they inside? They're ravening wolves. They're out there, they look like sheep, but what are their hearts like? Their hearts are like ravening wolves who would tear you apart and trample on their pearls. Paul explains what's really happening with these kinds of people. Look at 1 Corinthians 13, if you haven't read this for a while. I'll read it. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I can even remove mountains, so that I can heal people, so that, like he's saying in chapter 7 of Matthew, and have not charity, I'm nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it doesn't do me anything, any good. It profiteth me nothing. Mormon says the same thing in Moroni. A man being evil cannot do that which is good. For if he offereth a gift or prayeth unto God, except he shall do it with real intent, it profiteth him nothing. So without love, the works we do are empty. And even, Jesus is saying, iniquitous. Without real intent, there's no use. Isn't that amazing? He is being so strong about it. Lucifer knows that Jesus is the Christ, but it doesn't save him or benefit him. We can know something, but unless we act with real intent, it profiteth us nothing. Unless we act with love in our hearts, it profiteth us nothing. I like how Luke says it in Luke 6:45. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is good, and an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is evil. So he's talking about it all coming out of the heart. For the abundance of the heart his mouth speaketh. Haven't you found that nobody really hides anything from each other? Our antennas are always going, right? We pick things up, as we talked about last week. And in Hebrews, it says, Paul says, neither is there any creature that's not manifest in his sight, but all things are naked and open unto the eyes of him with whom we have to do. Sometimes when I'm writing down the canon, I quote that. I just love it. All things are naked and open. And I hope I'm clear. I just want to be clear all the way through. So, Jesus starts wrapping up here, his sermon. He has been wrapping up. He taught in chapter 5 how to be. He taught in chapter 6 how to relate to God. Diane talked about last week so beautifully. And now he's telling us in chapter 7 how to get along in this sad and wicked world and how to make our lives work. And his last words are a parable about what we build our life on. And it's about a rock. So two men, starting verse 24, so two men build their houses near a floodplain. One dug deep and reached the rock. The other built on sand, the alluvial deposit. The winter rains came, the floods came, the house on the rock held. The house on the sand fell with a dramatic clash, which is how he says, and great was the fall of it, the house. Have you ever camped on a floodplain? If you have, raise your hand. I want to see. Because I have. In Alaska, southeast Alaska, with a group of kids from BYU. And the floods came and the winds came and we barely got out of our lives. And I'm not kidding. I was in my sleeping bag going like this. Uh-oh. Because of the water, and the water was, you know, under the tent. So I kind of understand this little parable here. Jesus says, the man who builds his house on the rock is one, look at verse 24, who heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, and the foolish man who builds his house on the sand hears his sayings but does not do them. So here's what I think he's saying. If you live your life how I've been teaching you, if you do what I've been teaching you, you will have a happy, stable, fulfilled life. I'm connected to the Father, mentally healthy, unafraid, and hopeful, loving and loved, and you will be clear and full of light and full of life. Life. Why in the world would we choose anything else? Why would we not, as Neil Maxwell said, break free of our old selves, the provincial, constraining, complaining selves. He loved alliteration, Neil Maxwell, so he uses those constraining. But I love the word provincial. And that is sometimes how we are. We only can see our own world, can't we? There's so much out there, so much life and light. He says, yield yourself to God. Okay, the last two verses are really interesting of chapter 7 of the whole sermon. And it came to pass when Jesus had ended, the people were astonished at his doctrine. Why? Because he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. So when the scribes taught, they were lawyers. This is what a lawyer does. He uses precedent, and that's what they did. They just used what was in the Talmud. They would quote what other people had said. But for Jesus, he was his own authority. And they were amazed. He was talking like he was the authority. You can see the cultural difference. His authority was an authority of love. The scribes, when they would walk around and they would see a sick, leper or whoever on the ground, they would tighten up their robes, because if you touched anybody, even your robe, would become unclean, right? Whereas Jesus went everywhere touching with his hands. He put his hands in the boy's ears to heal him. He spat and touched his tongue with his spit. The boy that was dumb and couldn't speak. He touched the blind man who was always touching people, so you can see the difference. His authority was from the Father. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you, he said in John 14. So people listening to him could hear the language of another world, the language of God. And they recognized it. Never man spake like this, the officer said to the Pharisees and chief priests when they arrested Jesus. Never man spake like this. Alma said to Helaman, his son, for as surely as this director did bring our fathers by following its course to the promised land, shall the words of Christ, if we follow their course, carry us beyond this veil of sorrow into a far better land of promise. Isn't that so beautiful? I think he means this world too. I think when you have two grandchildren die, I know you've had your own sorrows, but I think he means this here too. We have to go back to the words. That is what will heal us. I didn't mean to do this. My favorite part of the great doctrine, the sermon, is actually in verse 6. So look with me there. I don't know why, it's always just pierces my heart. And You know, sometimes, even a month ago, I don't know about you, but you have thoughts that enter your head and they stay there. Ideas. And this idea has been in my head for maybe a month. And what it was that anything good that has ever happened to me has come out of the blue from God. There was nothing I could do to ever make it, and I could, you know, tell you things, but I mean, I met my husband, it was just totally out of the blue. He just brought him to me, like serendipity. I personally think that's how God works, that if you live your life trying to seek first, as he says in verse 6 of 33, if you seek the kingdom of God, all these and his righteousness, all these things will be added unto you. So I've had these thoughts going through my head. Everything good has just been given to me. I couldn't change one thing. So let's just read. Starting with, if we had time, we could read the whole thing, but he says, which of you, verse 27, which of you, of chapter 6, which of you by taking thought can add one cubit unto his stature? We can just pound away all we want, but our lives are under his control. He says, and why, and this is the part I love, why take ye thought for raiment? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Wherefore, if God so clothed the grass of the field, which today is, and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith? So, let us yield ourselves. I like that word yield. It's different than obedience. It involves, like Lorraine said, agency. We are free agents. We can choose life or we can choose death, and he's letting us do it. So by yielding ourselves to him, we are using our agencies. We're standing on our feet. We are being his children, and that is what he wants. He wants a choice, and that is my belief and testimony in the name of Jesus.